I'm Nikki Gamer, and this is Midday. The internet has become a place where many of us live our lives. We socialize, work, shop, bank, and are entertained, all within the confines of the World Wide Web. But for women, the online experience can sometimes be a negative one. And for some women, it can even be dangerous. Cyberstalking and internet harassment against women is not uncommon, and it starts early. Across the country, girls in their early teens are falling victim to online bullying and sexual shaming, which can sometimes have devastating real-life consequences. But for those making the threats under the cover of anonymity, there is not much in the way of punishment. This hour, women and online harassment. That's next on Midday. First, the news from NPR. Welcome back to the Midday Show. I'm Nikki Gamer in for Dan Rodericks today. Dan will be back tomorrow. Anne Marie Chiarini is a Maryland mother of two who found herself in a nightmare scenario a few years back. After breaking up with her boyfriend, she found pictures of herself naked splashed on the internet. These pictures were sent to her employer, her friends, family members, and she felt humiliated, so much so that she was afraid to go out in public. She's since become an advocate against what's being called revenge porn, and we'll be talking to her later on this hour about a bill before the Maryland General Assembly that would criminalize it. The topic of today's show is women and online harassment. I should point out here that we will be discussing sexually explicit material this hour that might not be appropriate for young ears. The internet has become a place where many of us live our lives. We socialize, work, shop, bank, and are entertained, all within the confines of the World Wide Web. But for women, the online experience can sometimes be a negative one. And for some women, it can even be dangerous. Cyberstalking and internet harassment against women is not uncommon. According to a 2005 Pew Research Center report, even though men and women spend an equal amount of time online, the vilest communications are still disproportionately lobbed at women. The journalist Amanda Hess knows what it's like to experience internet harassment. As a writer who covers sex, relationships, and women's issues, she's been at the receiving end of cyberstalking and some pretty shocking internet threats. And she's with us now to talk about it. Amanda Hess is a Slate staff writer. Her article, Why Women Aren't Welcome on the Internet, was published in January for Pacific Standard Magazine. Amanda Hess, welcome to the Midday Show. We're so happy to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you frame your article around this incident you had with a Twitter user who called himself Headless Female Pig. He sent you a series of texts, and let me read a few here. He said, quote, I'm going to rape you and remove your head. Also, you are going to die, and I am the one who is going to kill you. I promise you this. So what was your initial reaction to this thread?
Well, really, the story is about all of the contradictions that I faced when I received this threat and then tried to sort of figure out what my legal response should be. And so the thing that I felt most was confusion. I wasn't sure where the threat was coming from, whether it was someone I knew or who had harassed me in the past or someone who I had never been in contact with before. I didn't know if I had any sort of legal rights in this situation, if it constituted a criminal threat for someone to be sending me something anonymously over the internet. And I also wasn't sure if I should really feel afraid. When I talked to friends and colleagues about it, about half of them said something like, this guy seems unhinged, he seems like someone who would make a suit out of your skin, and you should really try and put him in court. And the other half of people I talked to said something like, it's just the internet, this happens all the time, just ignore it and move on with your life. So it was a very sort of grand sense of confusion for me as to what to do.
Now, as I understand it, and if this had been sent to me, I mean, of course, you go through a range of emotion, but this turned into anger for you. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, as you said, I sort of faced a variety of emotions, and I'm lucky that I was sort of able to turn my anger and frustration into something positive. The thing that sort of made me the most frustrated in the situation was not actually that some random person had threatened me. but that there are all these institutions set up, whether it's technology companies, the police force, other online commenters, who are sort of dismissing this issue and not taking it seriously. So it's not just, you know, an example of sad trolls making negative comments toward women, but also all of these very respected institutions that don't take it seriously and sort of allow the harm to continue to happen.
Okay, so take us back to what happened after you got this thread of tweets from Headless Female Pig, because you actually contacted the local authorities and they seemed kind of didn't really know what to do.
I did. So I called 911, and at the time I was on vacation in Palm Springs, so it was a place that I didn't even live. Probably my harasser did not live there, but you sort of don't know what to do other than call 911, and a local cop came to my hotel room, and I told him the situation, who I was, what had happened on Twitter, and his response was, "What is Twitter?" He was not sort of aware that Twitter was a billion-dollar platform where a lot of people have conversations and start relationships and pursue work. So from the very beginning, I was sort of working with police officers who not only didn't really understand sort of the modern landscape of the Internet, but also didn't understand why communication on those platforms might have real-world effects.
Now, do you have any idea why this person was targeting you?
I don't. One of the sort of most frustrating things about this situation was this sort of catch-22 that happens. So when I sort of explained to the cop what Twitter was, his next reaction was, you know, we don't know who this guy is. He says that he lives in California, which is where I lived at the time, and that he, you know, is going to come to your house and rape and behead you. But we don't know if he's lying, so he could be in Nebraska for all we knew. And the frustrating thing was, because he could live in Nebraska, the police would not investigate the crime to actually figure out if he did live in Nebraska or if he did live in California. So it was difficult to know how immediate the threat was without a sort of initial investigation into it. So I have no idea who he was. What he claims is that he read an article that I had written, and he didn't like it. And so his response was to, you know, ridicule my body and to make sexual comments to me, and then ultimately to threaten to rape and kill me.
Now, this was not a unique experience. You've been on the receiving end of this many times, and these are hypersexualized threats, right? This isn't just, you know, I want to hurt you. This is hypersexualized here.
Yeah, what I found, you know, in just sort of my own experience and in the experience of many women I know who have even a sort of small presence on the Internet, whether they're women who are just using an online dating site or they work in the tech field or they are online journalists, the threats against us tend to be gendered. And so a lot of people receive sort of vile abuse on the Internet, but for women, there seems to be, it seems that our gender itself is targeted, not our ideas. And that's something that is not new to the Internet. It's something that, you know, happens in sexual harassment cases in the workplace, sexual harassment on the street. And so what we're seeing is all of these crimes against women that have been taken more seriously in sort of real-life scenarios are now replicating themselves on the Internet, and we don't necessarily have the tools and the laws to deal with them in the same way that we do sexual harassment in the workplace, for example.
Well, now that we're talking about laws, what sort of legislation is in place at the federal level that deals with this, if there are any?
There are certain laws in place, and they're, you know, they really run the gamut. So in California, which is where I was, a criminal threat doesn't sort of preclude prosecution based on platform. So if someone threatens me criminally on the Internet, it should sort of be treated by the law in the same way as someone who does it in person or who, you know, nails a letter to my door or what have you. But the the difficulty is in getting police to actually investigate these crimes and getting people to sort of prosecute people for them. So that's the sort of difficulty, is that there are, you know, there are many laws that can be applied to internet harassment, general sort of stalking laws. There are now sort of emerging some specific laws tailored to the internet, like anti-revenge porn laws. There's one in California now. But for the most part, we have a lot of laws in place that could be applied to this. It's just that, you know, police forces don't have the education and the training, and they certainly don't have the resources to follow up on every threat that's being made over the internet, because there are quite a few of them that are happening.
Right. I wanted to talk about this disconnect. I just want to really hone in on this, that the experience of the people making and investigating the threats is often very different than the people on the receiving end. And you talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so one of the sort of problems that you can sort of very easily see is that people who are controlling tech companies that are creating the platforms that we're using, and people who are investigating crimes, both of these industries are hugely dominated by men. And so while I don't have any grand solutions for how to deal with this huge problem of internet harassment, stands to reason that if people who had these experiences themselves, who understood gendered harassment better, it might be a little bit easier for us to actually investigate these crimes and take them seriously.
Now, can you talk a little bit, because you wrote in this piece, we have a local law professor, University of Maryland law professor, Danielle Citrone, who's doing work on this front. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So Danielle is someone who has, been working with women for a long time who have been stalked on the internet, harassed on the internet, had, photoshopped naked photos of them sort of spread around the internet. And what she found was that, you know, these women weren't only sort of feeling the immediate effects of being harassed or threatened online, but that those threats and that harassment was also beginning to affect their economic potential. So she met women who had trouble getting jobs because when you searched for their name on Google, it came up with a bunch of vile material. She talked with women who were being sort of harassed by other people on their campuses, so found it difficult to attend classes because they knew that sort of anonymous people who were actually people that they knew were harassing them online. And what she's done is sort of create a legal framework for starting to see internet harassment as a form of discrimination that could potentially be remedied in the form of civil rights legislation, similar to civil rights legislation that has been drafted to address sexual harassment in workplaces, or civil rights legislation that's been drafted to ensure equal opportunity for education for women through Title IX. And so her sort of idea is to begin to extend those protections of women to the internet. Now, how that actually happens is a huge debate,
right.
And it's something that people on sort of all sides of the issue are just beginning to talk about.
Well, if we go back to your particular case, did anything ever happen with this Twitter handle, Headless Female Pig? I mean, what happened with that?
So nothing happened. I followed up a bit with local police in Palm Springs. Part of the problem that I found was that all of the sort of processes that local police were using were analog. So because I didn't live in Palm Springs, I had to sort of call them to try and get my police report to make sure that they had created a record of this happening, which is most of what I wanted. So, in case anything happened in the future, I could sort of prove that I had followed up on it and I had sort of codified this information in an authoritative source. But because all of their information was sort of filed in an analog way, and I don't live in Palm Springs, it was very difficult for me to even get any documentation of my case. It was not investigated by local police. I later called the FBI, which I realize sounds a little bit silly, but what I had sort of come to understand is that federal investigators do have the tools to investigate these crimes. They do have an understanding of internet crimes, but what they don't have is the bandwidth to investigate, you know, every single person who's threatened on the internet. So I didn't get very far there either.
So he's still out there. He could still be ready to send you more of these.
Yeah. And so on the technological side, Twitter did suspend this anonymous person's account. They had created the account really only to threaten me. So it wasn't as if their name or their sort of personal brand was at stake. They could just start another Twitter account whenever they wanted to. So I didn't get very far, you know, on either side, but I did sort of gain a better understanding of how what these crimes are and how they're not being dealt with.
Now, are these social media platforms stepping up to the plate on this? I know, you know, post Edward Snowden NSA, there's probably more pressure on them to keep, you know, these accounts private. So how is that being dealt with?
Well, that's the sort of most interesting part of the issue is that there are all of these technology companies that have so much money and are, you know, they have some sort of incentive to be responsive to their users. And users are sort of petitioning Twitter and Facebook to deal with these issues better. But what they don't have is any legal authority to prosecute people. And then you sort of look at the police, who don't really have any money, but they have all of the authority that you might need. And so there's this disconnect between these two different bodies.
Right.
And, you know, there are a lot of sort of very good reasons why Twitter might want to keep its users anonymous and to not go after people who say threatening things on the platform, because the anonymity of Twitter is used for all sorts of positive reasons, for political protests. And they, you know, sort of have to make a value calculation about whether it's worth getting rid of all of these positive aspects of anonymity in order to go after trolls, basically.
Right. And
I think it's unlikely that they're going to sort of rethink that calculation anytime soon, but it would be interesting to see how they react to it.
Well, I want to wrap this up here, but I do want to ask, why write about this? Why should people care? You know, there's probably people out there that said, you know, are siding with those people that say these are just pranksters, you know. What is, I guess, your takeaway after writing this story?
I mean, I wrote the story not necessarily because I thought it was a very important topic, although I do, but I just thought it was endlessly interesting. Everywhere I went, whether it's, you know, talking to people who don't think it's a problem and people who think it's a huge problem, talking to police who think it's Twitter's problem or Twitter who thinks it's the police's problem, there were all just so many contradictions in how people are dealing with this issue that I just thought it was fascinating to lay out all of the different ways that we are dealing or not dealing with. And what I found was, because there's so much contention as to who should be actually dealing with this problem, that the weight of everything falls on the victims. And that's sort of what I want people to take away from this case, is that if we don't do anything, we're really just punishing women for existing on the internet.
Right. Wow. Well, I have to congratulate you. This was a fantastic piece. And thank you so much, Amanda Hess, for joining us. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you for having me.
Again, Amanda Hess's article on women and online harassment is called Why Women Aren't Welcome on the Internet, and it was published in January by Pacific Standard Magazine. We have to take our first break here, but when we come back, more on women and online harassment. Up next, for some middle and high school girls, digital sharing can have immediate and disastrous effects. We'll talk about sexual shaming in the internet age. Stay with us. And welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Nikki Gamer, sitting in for Dan Rodericks today. Dan will be back tomorrow. This hour, we're talking about women and online harassment. I want to turn now to a chilling reality in middle and high schools across the country. We're calling attention to it because it's also a reality for students here in Maryland. I'm talking about teenagers and online sexual shaming. In a few minutes, we'll be talking to a talented young reporter who put together a piece on this for New York City Public Radio. But at the top here, I wanted to address what's happening on this locally. Last month, students at an Anne Arundel Middle School used cell phones and social media to distribute nude images of their classmates. At least one student created an Instagram page using the school's initials to post the photos. When certain parents got wind of what was going on, a social media firestorm erupted. My colleague here at WIPR, Mary Rose Madden, reported the story when it first broke, and she's continuing to follow it. In this piece, she talked to a girl at the middle school about sexual shaming among her peers.
Megan, who asked we not use her real name, sips a vanilla milkshake in a coffee shop near her school. She fidgets with her sleeves and leans forward to discuss middle school sex, cyber sharing, and sexting, sharing nude or semi-nude images via an electronic device. She's friends with several girls who sent photos of themselves topless to various boys in their school. From there, the photos were sent around the school and posted to an Instagram page that contained the initials of their school, Chesapeake Bay Middle, and referred to the girls as hoes, or thoughts, which stands for that hoe over there. Megan says some of the girls wanted to impress boys they liked, or they were sending the photos to their boyfriends. But some of the girls were manipulated into sending the photographs, she says.
My other friend got pressured into doing it. Like, the boys were threatening her, saying that if she didn't do it, they would tell everyone that she, like, did all this stuff with, like, a guy that was, like, it's not true, but they said that they were going to tell anyway. They would make up rumors about her.
She shows the photos. One is of a bare-breasted girl from the neck down.
And in this one, you can see she said happy because the guys were, like, pressuring her.
The incident set off a social media firestorm among parents. Megan says one of the girls became suicidal and another was stalked.
One of them, after she was, like, exposed, she was telling me how a kid in high school was asking to, like, rape her.
The Instagram page has been taken down, but Megan says screenshots have been distributed.
So girls will get called names and they'll get, like, they'll lose a lot of their friends for it, but the boys gain friends for it. A kid in my class got ones from one of my friends, showed the whole entire class, all the guys were like, yeah.
But it's not just the boys who distribute the photos. Girls send them around too.
The girls will gang up on other girls for the pictures that they send. They tell other people about it, like the people that don't know, they tell people about it. The girls are mean.
Caroline Knorr, the parenting editor at Common Sense Media, a nonpartisan media group, says this kind of public humiliation has a name.
You've shared an inappropriate image of other people, and then you isolate and basically bully and humiliate that other person. And that's called slut shaming.
It's the kind of vilification Knorr has seen in national stories from Silicon Valley, California, to Steubenville, Ohio.
You know, we are seeing that type of situation play out in middle schools and high schools, and I would encourage parents to talk to their sons and daughters about what's going on there and how to stand up for victims of these crimes.
And Arundel County Police say they've investigated the incident, but that no one will be charged. Studies vary, but somewhere from 8 to 19% of kids under 18 have sent sexting messages. The potential for those sexts to cause serious harm is high. Back at the coffee shop, Megan says there's a lot of pressure at her school to have sex, and it's been there since the sixth grade. She says a lot of girls want to act more mature or feel pressure to please others.
And everyone tells me when you're in high school, it gets a lot better. I hope so.
She seems pretty optimistic about this, looking up to see if an older person will confirm what she wants to believe. I'm Mary Rose Madden, reporting from Anne Arundel County for 88.1 WYPR.
Wow, that's some chilling stuff. That was Mary Rose Madden, WYPR senior producer and reporter, talking with an Anne Arundel Middle School student about sexual shaming. Mary Rose Madden will be continuing to follow this story, so look out for updates on the WYPR website. You're listening to The Midday Show. I'm Nikki Gamer, sitting in for Dan Rodericks this hour, and today we're discussing women and online harassment. I want to welcome onto the show now New York City Public Radio's Temitayo Fagbenle. or Tammy Fegbenlay. She's a radio rookie reporter for WNYC who goes to high school in Manhattan, and her piece that caught our attention is called Sexual Cyberbullying, the Modern Day Letter A. Tammy Fegbenlay, welcome to the Midday Show. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Did I get that right?
It's Tammy Tile Fegbenlay.
Okay.
So you were pretty close.
Okay, good. This piece was so interesting, and you started off by talking about Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter as a way of introducing sexual shaming, because this is something that's been around for a long time.
Right, yeah. So, I mean, I definitely saw a parallel between what happened to Hester in the story and what happens to girls today in terms of sexual cyberbullying online.
So we should just say Hester is the one who gets cast out of her community and is made to wear the letter A.
Yeah.
So tell us about, you know, that connection between what happened to her and then what you see happening now.
So today it's a little bit less of a marking, and it's more of a digital brand that people put on you. So it's not that girls are walking around with a letter A, and I think today it's a little bit worse because not only do people they know have these images of them, it's people they don't know. Once these images are online, you know, people, can, from California, and we're in New York City, can grasp these photos and really have these very private parts of their life in the palm of their hand.
Talk about what you see on your Facebook feed related to this.
So I see sexual cyberbullying a lot on my Facebook feed. Facebook has this new feature where you can see what your friends like and what your mutual friends like. So the things that my friends like will come up on my Facebook feed, and even though I'm not personal friends with these people who put out these images and these videos of young women in these positions, I see them because other people like it. So in that way, things can spread very quickly.
You talked to a young woman who had a video taken of her online, and it spread very quickly. So can you tell us a little bit about her?
So I interviewed a girl from my school who, a former boyfriend of hers, he put up a video of them together in a sexual manner, and he put it up on, I believe, on WorldStar, on YouTube, and on Twitter. And I never actually saw the video. I saw parts of it, but it spread very quickly. As soon as I came to school the next day, people were talking about it. I saw some things on Facebook that people who didn't attend our school were talking about it. It was a very big thing in our school, and even today, that happened when I was in ninth grade. Even today, people will still talk about it, and I'm in 12th grade now.
And what happened to that girl? I can imagine that is horrifying.
Right. So she was actually very strong about it. She actually stayed in the school. She still goes to my school. She lost a few friends because of the incident, but she still has a group of friends who she leans on and who support her, you know, when people will come up to her and say things. So, I mean, I admire her personally for her resilience, for staying in the school, because I saw how people would treat her when they would walk past her, or even her friends who just stopped hanging out with her because of what happened.
How do you feel as a young person realizing that this is happening among your peers and thinking, well, this doesn't seem right? Why are these girls doing, why are they sending the pictures out in the first place?
How do I feel?
Yeah. What do you think about this?
Well, I think it's horrible. I think it's horrible that people are vilifying the human body. I don't think of the human body as something that should be censored. And even though there's these young girls doing it in the confidence of their boyfriend or whoever the person is that's sent it to them. So I think I don't judge the women that do it. I judge the men for breaching that confidence of trust.
Who is putting these pictures online? Is it mostly men, or is it some young women as well?
I mostly see men doing it. In some cases, I'll see young women that put up these pictures or videos, sometimes of their friends or sometimes of girls they don't like, so they can shame them.
I want to play a little tape from your piece. This is you interviewing a male friend of yours who, when he was in seventh grade, sent around a picture of his girlfriend without a shirt on to some of his friends, and the picture spread around the entire school.
Did she transfer out of the school after?
Nope. She stayed and continued to be the smut, smitty, slide, skip, scap, scallywap, you know, whore.
I don't want to make an assumption because he's a friend of mine, but maybe he doesn't understand the seriousness of what he did.
So did you intend it to be malicious?
I guess I thought it would be cool or something. It took me a day to send it out. And then from a day, it just went around until it finally got back to the school and the teacher saw it.
Now, this friend of yours, he was arrested for this?
Yeah, he was arrested.
I want to hear a little bit more from your interview with him, and then we'll hear your comments after.
You said that when you decided to do it, you thought it would make you cool. So did it make you cool?
Yeah, after it happened, there was a lot of like, yeah, man, that was awesome.
You sound pretty unremorseful right now.
I regret doing it to her, but still, I didn't have to go to jail. Porn websites do it every day, so even the girls gave me props.
I guess the thing that surprises me most about this is the girls doing this to each other and treating themselves in this way. Did you find that surprising in your reporting?
I didn't find it surprising only because I've seen instances of sexual cyberbullying and I've seen girls target other girls. And I think the majority of, I think, the power comes from these girls who gang up against other girls and say, you know, oh, she's a whore and this is wrong. And when you see guys in the same situation, guys will praise their counterpart and girls will do exactly the opposite. And add on to the men who are blasting this girl and putting her and shaming her publicly. So when you have your demographic, you have women, and then you have men who are both coming together to shame you, then you're really at a loss in terms of, like, power.
Now, this friend of yours, he didn't sound... Do they realize that these pictures are going to stay online forever? Do they realize sort of the lifeline... lifetime of these pieces of media?
They do realize, but because it doesn't personally affect them and because it increases their popularity in most cases, they don't really care. So they will put these pictures up, they will put these videos up. Actually, when I interviewed him, he was told to delete the photos, but he actually still has them. So I think that's just a testament to, you know, how permanent these things are. Once they go on the internet, you can't actually really, once something's on the internet, you really have no control over where it goes or who has property or domain over it.
There was I got a sense from him that he really did not seem to, he just seemed laissez-faire about it. Has that changed, or is this sort of the general sentiment of young people today?
Has it changed for him?
Yeah, he sounded really nonchalant about what happened.
Yeah, I mean, I talked to him today, and he seems to matured a little bit on the topic of it, but it's still pretty much a nonchalant attitude in regards to what he did and how it affected the girl. With other guys who've done things like this, you'll get pretty much the same sort of response. Actually, his response was kind of tame in comparison to the other guys I know who've done things like this.
Wow. I just wanted to know, what do you hope that people take away from your reporting of this piece?
Well, I want people to know that it happens, because I think that people get the idea that once this girl leaves the environment or once she leaves that community, that it's going to be over. But the thing about sexual cyberbullying, sexual harassment, is that these things are sort of have a eternal lifespan, because once it's the internet is just a really like unexpirable thing, and these things spread so quickly and so vastly that people get their hands on it, and it's like a forest fire. And I want people to really know that this shouldn't define how somebody's treated or their life in general. Like, people shouldn't like look this up and then like and have to deal with it for the rest of their lives.
Right. Well, Tommy Taiofag Benlay, it's been a pleasure speaking with you, and congratulations on such wonderful reporting. Now, you graduate from high school this June. Are you going to continue with journalism?
Yeah, I am.
Excellent. Well, we'll be following your work from afar. Thank you for being on our show today.
All right. Thank you for having me.
We have to take another break here, but when we come back, more on women and online harassment. Up next, should it be illegal to get back at an ex by putting nude pictures of him or her online? We'll talk about what's being called revenge porn with a local lawmaker who is pushing to criminalize it in Maryland. And we'll speak with a victim who's sharing her story with the hope of putting an end to the practice worldwide. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Midday Show. I'm Nikki Gamer, sitting in for Dan Rodericks today. Dan will be back tomorrow. We're talking this hour about women and online harassment, and I'd like to turn now to another troubling trend in the digital age. It's called revenge pornography, or revenge porn. In the last few years, there have been a number of websites devoted to revenge porn, with jilted exes free to post pictures of their former lovers online with impunity. But with the proliferation of these sites, it's something that local legislators are trying to deal with nationwide. In Maryland, there's a bill before the General Assembly that, if passed, would make revenge porn a felony. Here with me now to talk about that bill is one of its co-sponsors, State Delegate John Cardin. Delegate John Cardin is a Democrat from Baltimore County, and he's also a candidate for Maryland Attorney General. Delegate Cardin, welcome back to the Midday Show. Thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
I also want to welcome onto the show now Anne-Marie Chiarini, a victim of revenge porn who has turned her experiences into advocacy work. Anne-Marie Chiarini, welcome to the Midday Show. Thank you for being here.
Hi, thanks so much.
All right, Anne-Marie, let's start with you. I want you to take us back to the breakup that inspired all of this. After you ended things with the man who you were in a relationship with, tell us what happened next.
So we had a relationship-ending fight, and after the fight on the phone later on that evening, he had threatened to begin an eBay auction where he was going to auction off a CD containing nude images of me. At first, it was a threat, and I didn't take it too seriously. But before we hung up the phone, he said, "I will destroy you." And that's when I knew he was serious. And the next day, the auction went up, and I went into full-on crisis mode to get the links down. He had put links on the Facebook pages of the college where I teach. He had sent copies of the CD to the chair of the department of the college where I teach, to my son's kindergarten teacher, the Catholic school he attends. He was truly out to destroy me.
Wow.
I also sought the help of local law enforcement, and unfortunately, I found out at the time that no crime had been committed. He did nothing wrong. And so I unfortunately had to let it go, and this is in 2010. After 14 months of no contact in 2011, I received an anonymous email stating that a profile had been created featuring nude images of me. So I Googled my name, and the porn website X-Hamster came on, and there were my pictures. But not only that, there was also my full name, the town where I live, the college and campus where I teach, and a solicitation for sex.
Wow.
So that's when the crisis became much more severe, because I then became a target for offline stalking.
Sure.
And the danger became physical. Again, I sought the help of local law enforcement, and no crime had been committed. Ironically, the perpetrator lives in New Jersey, and when I contacted the police in New Jersey, they said the same thing. No crime has been committed. He did nothing wrong. However, New Jersey had a law on the books since 2004 in the wake of the Tyler Clemente suicide, making this sort of behavior criminal. So at that point, I was so frustrated. I was talking to this wonderful state trooper who was really working hard to help me. And I said, "That's it. I'm changing the laws." And I've been working as an advocate ever since.
Right. I want to know, you know, besides, okay, so shock and humiliation, right? So it's a horrifying story. What else did you suffer as a result of the dissemination of these images?
I was very lucky. My friends and family supported me unconditionally, and they were wonderful. I did not lose my job. Certainly, I am not looked upon favorably anymore. However, I was not fired, as many, many women are. As well, I was not kicked out of the graduate program that I was in at the time, again, as many women are. I was so lucky to be supported. And as far as personally, I suffered from severe anxiety, almost an obsessive need to see what was going on online, to Google my name, to check my email, to check my Facebook page, to check the college's Facebook page. I would pop awake at hours. Finally, I was afraid to leave the house for months on end. And at one point, at the worst, when I realized that this probably was never going to end, I attempted suicide.
Wow. Can I ask you, some people out there might be listening to this and said, well, she shouldn't have taken these pictures, or she shouldn't have sent them to this person. So have you heard that? And what is your reaction to that?
I hear that constantly. And my reaction is that it's time that we start looking at the malicious behavior. My behavior may not have been agreeable to many people. However, I did not do what I did. I did not agree to have those pictures taken with a maliciousness in mind. I did not do it with an intent to destroy. I did not do it with an intent for revenge. The focus has to be changed onto the perpetrators who are taking this gift, this representation of the trust that exists within a relationship, and using it to do harm to another person.
Right.
The perpetrators are not having, nothing's happening to them. My perp got away. He's living his life, no big deal. But, all the victims here are suffering, and we're the ones being blamed, even though we didn't do anything with malicious intent or with vengeful intent.
Did you even think before you sent the pictures of, okay, I'm sending something over an electronic communication, and this could go somewhere where I don't want it to go?
Absolutely not. This man and I, we dated in the 80s, and we were going to get married in 1990. I decided to go to college. This was someone who I had a very, very long-term relationship with. This is someone who I trusted implicitly, and I did not go into this relationship thinking this person is going to betray me in the worst way possible. Most people don't go into relationships saying, okay, so I'm now with this man or woman, and this person is going to betray me.
Right. Delegate Cardin, tell us about your bill.
Sure. Well, first, let me just applaud the efforts of Anne Marie. She has been a terrific advocate on this, and working with Danielle Citron at the University of Maryland Law School to draft the legislation. Basically, first of all, it already has passed the House. It passed the House unanimously, and now we're waiting to see if there's action that's going to be taken in the Senate Judicial Proceedings Committee. This bill would basically criminalize intentionally putting somebody's naked image online without their permission and causing with the intent to cause emotional distress to that person. And the fact of the matter is that you're not just talking about sending somebody a naked image of yourself over line. What if somebody takes a picture and scans it in? There are
right.
all kinds of opportunities to destroy somebody's life with a click of a mouse. Anne Marie was not fired, but people can lose their jobs, people can lose relationships, people can lose family trust. Just because somebody else is taking advantage of them without their consent, and that is the reason why I was so fortunate to be the lead sponsor of this bill, to help people like Anne Marie, who has been a tremendous advocate, people who have been victimized in ways that they can't stop. And as you've already, your previous guests have already mentioned, once this information is out there on the web, it's nearly impossible to have it taken off. So that's there. It's there forever without that person's permission. It is, to me, it's criminal to destroy somebody's life without their permission in doing so.
Now, there are already laws in California and New Jersey?
That's correct.
Okay. Now, this was curious to me. Some photos that end up on revenge porn websites are a result of hacking in Photoshop. Have you heard about that?
Right. Well, yes, I have. And certainly that was something that was brought up in our testimony. And the fact of the matter is that there is a intent to put the image up. And by definition, by legal definition, it has to actually be a legitimate image. And the intent to do harm to somebody by putting the image up, by creating emotional distress. And we believe that we have covered that issue. And in fact, you know, we don't have the privacy rights and the First Amendment rights people 100% on board. But we believe we certainly meet constitutional muster. And we think that we are protecting these victims because they are victims. And the perpetrators are already, as Anne-Marie has already discussed, are already living their lives without any worry about any ramifications of these actions, which are destroying people's lives.
Delegate Cardin, let me stop you here. Why is this a criminal issue versus a civil matter?
Sure, another good question. Certainly, there's opportunities to handle this in civil court. But as you may be aware, many of your listeners are aware, it can oftentimes be cost prohibitive, and it can be difficult to put together as an individual the kind of investigation that needs to be done, whereas the state oftentimes has the investigative ability. It's also a higher standard, so it has to meet certain criteria for it to be a criminal matter.
Sure.
But, you know, the fact is, I consider this cyber sexual assault, not just revenge porn. It's not just about vengeance. It's about putting somebody's image out there without their permission is assault of that person. It is harassment of that person, and it needs to be contained through a criminal statute.
Sure. Okay, we only have a couple more minutes. Anne-Marie Tirini, tell us quickly about this cyber rights initiative that you're a part of.
Okay, so the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative is a campaign it's a nonprofit organization that is looking to answer the call for legal and educational response to cyber harassment. We're a nonprofit. We engage in advocacy work through the development of individual campaigns, and our first campaign, our main one, is the End Revenge Porn campaign. We are an outreach organization, so victims can contact us through the Cyber Civil Rights website or the End Revenge Porn website, and we can give them advice. We've vetted resources that we can point them to. We can help explain the laws in their states. We've had many victims who've contacted us who want to get involved and who want to change legislation in their states.
Sure.
So we have the resources to guide them.
Okay. Well, we will try to link to that on the Dan Rodrick's Facebook page. We're about out of time here. We've just been speaking now with Maryland State House Delegate John Cardin of Baltimore County, who is the co-sponsor of a bill that would criminalize revenge porn in the state of Maryland. The bill has unanimously passed the House and is waiting on action in the Senate. Delegate Cardin, thanks for spending some time with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Also with me was Anne-Marie Chiarini, a victim of revenge porn and an advocate for reform. Anne-Marie, thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you so much for having us. We appreciate the positive media attention.
Sure. All right. That is it for today's Midday Show. Dan Rodrick's will be back tomorrow. I do want to thank Atwaters for providing us with today's lunch. Atwaters supports local radio, local farmers, and local appetites at Belvedere Square, the shops at Kenilworth, Bear Hill, and Main Street, Catonsville. Also, a big thank you to all of you, our listeners, for tuning in. Have a great afternoon, and we will see you again tomorrow.
Midday's senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer and director is Jonathan Ahrens. The associate producer, Michael Himowitz. Our interns are Luke Spicknell, James Daly, Tom Cartaxo, and Michelle Richardson. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming available at WYPR.org. Dan Rodrick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.